Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 3 for Spring Semester 2014. Lecture 20, delivered on April 8, 2014. The title of this lecture is Common Stock.
Today, Common Stock. Start off with a kind of well-known in the business fact about Common Stock and issuing Common Stock. But before that, let me make sure you remember that common stock represents ownership in a company. It is equity. It has the residual claim on cash flows after the debts have been satisfied in their timely manner. Common stock is kind of famous because it's sort of like when you think of investments, you think of buying stock. And when you think of buying stock, you're probably referring to common stock. Although there are different flavors of common stock sometimes, and I'll bring that up here in a minute or two. But you might have heard, well, such and such company just issued common stock. It did its IPO, its initial public offering. That is the first time that it sells stock to the general public, is the initial public offering. However, companies can then go on later to do other public offerings, second public offerings, third public offerings, as they want to raise money. Facebook is one that was in the news a while back. They did their IPO. Now, let me write down a couple of facts here. The sale of new common stock, and other things, is governed by the Securities Act of 1933. This gives all of the laws about issuing stock, and then a regulatory agency called the Securities and Exchange Commission interprets those laws and from them crafts regulations that are what we follow. We don't follow the law exactly. We follow the regulations that are created pursuant to the law. Now, once stock has been issued and it's out there trading back and forth, that is more the can of the Securities Exchange Act of 1934. This one... tells about all the rules about buying and selling stock that has already been issued by a company. Now remember that once the company has already issued the common stock, what happens after that to the stock is really not the company's business in a way. That's just you have stock, you want to sell it, I want to buy stock, so we might be able to come to an agreement on how that works. And there are exchanges that make it very easy so that I don't ever have to see you, you don't have to see me. We just do. We just put it out there and it's taken care of for us. But the IPO would be governed by the Securities Act of 1933. Now, there are different ways that you can issue common stock. First things first here is that you could actually sell common stock via an exemption from all of the regulations of the Securities Act of 1933. There are a number of different flavors of these exemptions that would allow you to slip through and do it without the massive amount of paperwork that an IPO, a real public offering, would make. A number of these are under Regulation D, exemptions. Now, these were sort of my bread and butter when I was in the business of consulting. getting stock out there to raise some money for the company, raise some equity capital for the company, without having to go through the morass and nightmare of a registration statement under the Securities Act of 1933. There are a couple of different ones of this. There's a 504, the Reg D 504, which allows a company to actually sell up to $1 million worth of stock without doing the whole registration statement, and the stock is freely tradable. It can trade back and forth. Now, it'd have to be listed on an exchange to do that, but theoretically, it's not restricted stock. This is called a $1 million offering. And remember, states also have their say in this, and there's many states have a uniform kind of way that you can carry out a quick low-end offering. And I did these quite frequently, Reg D 504s, back in the day. It's a little tougher now than it used to be, but... And then there are a couple of other exemptions under Reg D. One of them is called the 505. The other one is the 506, Reg D 505, Reg D 506. These two generate what is called restricted stock. This is stock that can't be bought and sold on an exchange, and you can't really buy and sell it otherwise, except under very specific conditions. Restricted means that it is subject to Rule 144. Rule 144 says you can't sell this except under very special conditions once you buy. Now, 505 and 506 are crafted for sale to sophisticated or well-seasoned investors. You can't just sell this 505. You can't rely on Reg D 505 or 506 to sell to someone like you. Not that you're not a sophisticated man. Hell, I've seen you. You drink beer that costs at least 50 cents a can. But this would have to be really sophisticated people who are know what they're getting into, that this is a risky company and all that. Yeah. Say that again. That one is the one that governs all public offerings, sales to the public or otherwise. But there are these exemptions that, and I'm going to get back into the morass a little bit of a registration statement. But you can get by with selling stock without filing all this awful paperwork under in reliance on these exemptions, but you can't just do it to anyone. You'd have to rely on their sophistication. Now, there are ways that you can bundle investors under a sophisticated investor, and there are all kinds of tricks, but these do not generate freely tradable stock. It is restricted. Rule 144. The restriction can be lifted only under certain conditions and following certain protocols. The 504, yeah, that's freely tradable. But again, the people who buy this stock, they've got to appreciate that, first of all, there's got to be a market for it. You've got to find some market makers who are willing to buy and sell in this stock. Second of all, this is probably as risky as hell, this kind of stock, which it was. I mean, all I did was, not all, but most of what I did was just penny stocks. Now, 505 and 506, those investors, they're going to be more on top of the company. Yeah, if we're going to buy equity position in this company, we're going to have a real serious say in this company. And we know the people who will explain to us what to tell you to do. We're owners. We're going to make sure that you follow what we want. There's another one called a Regulation A exemption. Again, restricted. And there are a couple of other exemptions. These are exemptions from all of the terrible paperwork. But the exemptions, of course, carry teeth. Restricted stock, and you can't raise more than a certain amount of money this way. 504 is $1 million. More for 505, 506, and Reg A. But you can't just sell stock at will. Going back up here, This is Securities Act of 1933 puts its teeth in and says, here you go. You want to raise a bunch of money. You want to sell stock. Well, you're going to have to do it by the rules. You have to file a registration statement. Registration statements come in two flavors. There's one that is, and I'll give you some of the names of the forms. The great big 800-pound gorilla is the form S1. I did one in my life. It was the worst experience of my life, but it was the biggest thrill in the world when when you make out a registration statement, you're going to file it with the SEC. The SEC is going to come back at you and say, you are ugly. You're a dumbass. Please get a job at McDonald's and stop trying to file registration statements. I did the Form S1 for this company. They wanted to raise a lot of money, worked out all of it. Now I couldn't do that because it's illegal for me to do that. Well, it was probably illegal back then, but what the hell. Statute of limitations is passed, so you can bite me. I sent it in, and I got back on my fax machine the deficiency notice. It's a list of everything that's wrong on it. It's your deficiencies. It was 406 deficiencies. I dropped mud. I thought I was pissed because I was going to have to buy more fax paper. So I called an old friend of mine. He, back in the day, he was a lawyer. He'd done registration statements. And he said, 406, huh? That's pretty good. Wait, what? So I went through each one, fixed each deficiency over a period of about 5 days. And I filed it again. 17 deficiencies came back. Okay, we'll do that. We'll fix the 17. Trying to figure out what the hell they meant in a couple of cases. Filed it again, and then came something I was totally not expecting. The registration statement had been qualified. Now remember, a government agency never approves of anything. Never approves of anything. It merely qualifies. So if you see qualification, that's the government's way of saying you're good to go. And I was expecting deficiencies to come out of, like 100 deficiencies, and it came back qualified. You know, I thought to myself, I don't need this crap from you guys. What the hell do you mean, qualified? Wait, what? But the qualification means that you are then set up. That doesn't mean you can start selling stock right away. It means you're set up to go. You got to get all the details in order. Final price, all that kind of stuff, and then you have to have a quiet period. In a registration, let me do one more thing here quickly. There are a couple of smaller offerings, like the Form SB1. That's a small business offering. It's restricted in the amount of money you can raise, but it's also one that I did. I did an SB1 once. And then there's a Form SB2. And there are a couple others here. I want you to remember S1 and an SB. On the other side, it's something else. If I've sold you stock, sucker, but I sold you stock, and I sold you stock in reliance on, let's say, a Reg D 506, sophisticated investors, and there were some less sophisticated investor bundled under you, and I sold some of this Reg D 506 stock. It's restricted. I can actually file a registration statement type that will release that from restriction and make it publicly tradable, freely tradable. It's called a Form 10. A Form 10 is like the seed that begins the life of a company that actually is kind of like private but has stock out there and opens it to become a public corporation. Now, in either of these cases, What's going to happen is that after you have become a public corporation, by the rules of the SEC, you then are responsible for filing timely documents. They're like amendments to your original registration statement. They describe the life continuing of the corporation. In other words, the registration statement itself says, here we are at the beginning of our public life. And then periodically, by law, you have to update that information. Your financials, your condition, your prospects, where your address is, and all that. These are called the Form 10-Ks and 10-Qs. In either case, once you become public, you will file Form 10-K every year. And then every quarter, you'll be filing the Form 10-Qs. The 10-Qs are like preliminary, sort of like flashes at a quarter. And then the K is the one at the end of the year that says, this is the definitive of what went on in the past fiscal year of the company. We call these the Ks and Qs. And I used to make money doing these because it's like the company suddenly realizes, especially with the kinds of companies that I did, took public, they didn't realize that it's not just about selling that stock and then becoming a public corporation. You get a ticker symbol if you do everything right. And no, you become responsible. You got to file these all the time. You can't miss. You can be a little late and they'll bitch at you and they might fine you, but you can't just walk away. The investors and the public, everyone gets to know your beeswax. We call these the K's and Q's. You also are responsible for filing some other things too. But I want to point out, you've seen me bring up financial statements. Those were K's. Those were financial statements in the K's. But there's more to the K's and Q's than just the financial statements. But this tells me what's going on with the company. There are a couple of others that might be of interest to you. There is the form 8K. An 8K is a document that you have to file whenever there is a meaningful, substantial, or material change in the company. You're the president of the company. You died. Well, I file an 8K for that. It's a timely notice to the public that this is an event that might impact on the company. One of my favorite things was 8Ks were really easy to file. So these companies that I was working for as a consultant, they would think that they could just issue press releases to pump up the price of the stock so they could sell some of their insider stock, pump and dump and all that. And every time they issued a press release, I explained to them, well, you got to file an 8K. Well, why? We just issued a press release. That's right, but when you file that press release, your intention was to affect the price of the stock. That is a material event in the company's life. So I just, every time they did that, I just charged them $50. It'd take me about 5 minutes to prepare the 8K. Since I was an Edgar filing agent, I did all the electronics myself. But these are worthwhile to look at. When you have a resignation from the board of directors, or when you have a press release, or when something, the question was always, well, what is the threshold for an important event, something you file on 8K? And I was always of the opinion, backed by others, that you do it if it's even a question. Then you file an 8K on it. And if you go to the Edgar filing system of the SEC, you'll see that most of the filings are 8Ks for many companies because there's always seems to be something going on that might be important to the life of the company. Okay. Now, let me pull back here. This is dense information. Don't worry, there's no math in it. Go ahead. Yeah.
Is that every quarter?
And then the Qs are the quarters. K is the annual. It's like the quarters are like the quickie snapshots, and then the K fills it in, audited financials and everything. Yeah. 10Q. It's again, it would be the quarter's financials, how you did that, you know, your income statement, balance sheet, and all of that for the quarter just ended. You would also give information about other things that have happened during that quarter. And then finally, you know, there are other things that you would put in there too. It's all the same stuff that you would put in the 10K, except it's preliminary. You can be a little bit looser on what you say in terms of, oh God, was this exactly what happened? No, but you have to clean it all up and put those Qs all together into a definitive K, which is essentially the actual amendment to your original filing of an IPO. And I want to point out something. As far as research on companies goes, and you're going to run into this before you're finished here, I'm pretty sure, if you you probably have already. A caution is that a 10K is a large, large document with a lot of information in it. That having been said, for analysts, of old school analysts, it's like a repository. There's a section in the Form 10, in the 10K, that is kind of really, it's kind of important to research. Or if you're really looking at a stock, remember these documents are prepared by company officials or their lawyers or their consultants. But at the heart of it, you have to be honest. The SEC is not going to trifle with you. So you see there's a section in the 10Ks. If you ever want to get some real deep detail, the kind of detail that the analysts that you would probably all go to, like at Hoover's or S&P Net Advantage, there's a section in the 10K called the MD&A, the Management Discussion and Analysis. Unfortunately, it's a big thing. It could go 100 pages, just the MD&A. But you will find that the people inside the company will be very honest about what has happened, why it's happened, and what their thinking is about what the impact of what has happened is going to be, and maybe even where they think the company is going to go. And it's not a PR document, so you're not blowing smoke up people's ass. You are actually, sometimes these things are glib as hell. They'll give you numbers. They'll say, all right, this is what happened. This is why this happened. This is how we're going to work on improving this, or we think this number is just where we wanted it to be. And it goes on and on, really digging in from the company's perspective, being really honest internally, being honest about it quite a bit of the time. And it's actually probably, if you were doing real hardcore research on a company in one of your classes or in your actual life that you'll be living, or if you're trying to find out about a company, go to the horse's mouth. Go to the MD&A. If you're looking for an employee being hired by a company, have a look at it. It's a read. And about back when I was a consultant, there was a push going on in the legal world between two forces. There was one group that was striving to get all legal documents, or a lot of legal documents, into plain English so that they didn't have all the legalese in them and all the technical terminology. So that things like insurance contracts weren't just full of legal terminology. So that things like 10Ks and registration statements were just piled with legal terminology, plain English. And then there was another camp that was fighting furiously against this, saying, no, we do not approve of this. The SEC had an open comment period on this for securities statements. Do we go to plain English, or do we stay with the technical legalese? Now, I don't know how you would guess I would go, but I was on the side, keep it legal, keep it technical. And the reason I did that, and I said, this is not like for other contracts like insurance or loans. I want to see those plain English, but I don't want to see registration statements. I don't want to see 10Ks get into plain English, because that is too inviting for idiots. That means that Ma and Pa Kettle can read the thing, and I don't want them to read it. I want them to stay the hell out of this world. This is not their world. But my side lost rather ingloriously, considering how few of us there were that were standing on that old, what sounded like, it sounded like we were a bunch of, you know, just old school fossils, you know, I like legalese. And there was more to it than that. It was, I didn't want these to be that inviting, that unsophisticated people could pick this up and think that it was a novel and think that, oh, stock is friendly, stock markets are great, I can do this like anyone else. I didn't want that. But that's how it is now. Plain English. These are not written in highly technical language. I've taught you enough in this class. You can read these things and understand what they're talking about. Anyway, enough of that promo. Okay. Now, I want to point out there's another trick. Usually you think of an IPO or a public offering. It doesn't have to be an IPO. You register on one of the forms a pile of stock, and then you sell it. 10 million shares of your company at $15 a share. There's another way it can be done. It's called a shelf registration, where you actually register an enormous amount of stock, and then you just put it on the shelf, and as you need equity money, you pull it off the stock shelf and sell it. It's like a serial offering. Many companies actually did one insanely large initial public offering, but they sold only a small amount of the stock to the market. The rest is on the shelf, and as they need money, they can just pull off a block of stock and sell it under that original registration statement. Where I ran into this, I actually ran into this when I was consulting for an REIT. An REIT is a real estate investment trust. They are exempt from taxes as long as most of the money that they make, they sweep back to the investors at the end of the year. And then they proceed forward, they'll have to raise more money to do new things. REITs buy real estate, like REITs buy shopping malls, strip malls, enclosed malls, walking malls. They buy things. There's REITs now that buy prisons, which is rather disgusting when you think about it. There are REITs that buy forests. There are REITs that buy everything. Well, the one I was working with was just into traditional strip malls. And so at the end of every year, the money that they had made from the rents from the malls that they owned and from selling properties that they owned, they would sweep almost all of it back to their stockholders. And then they would be tax exempt for doing this. But then they needed money for the next year. Well, how did they do it? Well, they'd go out and they'd find, okay, and I saw this happen. The first one was actually kind of interesting. They flew out to have a look at a mall in Wichita. And they thought, well, this is a good buy. We're going to buy the REIT is going to buy this, okay? Or the purchase price of the mall was about 12 mil. And so what did they do? They didn't have the money, obviously. They swept their money back to their investors at the end of the last year. So what they did was they called Nomura Securities. And they said, would you like to buy some stock? We've got this mall. They said, send us the information about the mall. We'll have an answer for you in 2 hours. Sent the information over to Japan. The Nomura Securities, the bank said, well, yeah, this is great. Okay, we'll make sure that we get the legal documents together. You should have the check within 24 hours in your bank account. And sure enough, it was there. Sure enough, Nomura Securities had a pile of stock that had been pulled off the shelf to sell to them. And then they had the check, and they flew back out to Wichita and bought them all. And that's how they did. That's one of the things that shelf registration can do. It's great for REITs. Also, big, huge corporations do it, so they're not constantly having to do public offerings to sell equity. Well, where was I? Okay. Now, the registration statement. Oh, my God, I did it again. Yeah. The registration statement. It contains different parts. Long ago, I was at a French restaurant, and I wanted to eat. And when I say I want to eat, that means I want a piece of dead cow muscle that is cooked enough so that it doesn't moo at me and it doesn't squirt blood at me, but not much more. I wanted the meat. Well, I went to this fancy restaurant, and the first thing that they did was play music for me and the people who were taking me there. I didn't want music. I wanted my cow. And then they brought me some kind of an apéritif, some little tiny snort of booze. You know, do French get drunk that easily? Damn, you know. And then they brought me this little appetizer thing. It was so small, you know, what the heck is this? Finally, they got to the meal. Yeah, that's what I wanted, the cow. And I ate that, and then they're coming with an after-dinner dessert, and then they had something after that. I didn't want that. I was full. I ate the cow. A registration statement is sort of like that. There's this thing in the middle called the prospectus. That's your selling document. But there's this stuff before it and this stuff after it. The registration statement is like a French dinner. Yeah, you got this part. I don't give a rat's ass about that. You got this last part. I'm already full. I'm burping. I need to find a place to take a shit. Okay? There in the middle is the part that I wanted at that restaurant, that prospectus, that selling document. That's what I hand to you and say, here you go, Gumby. Read it and buy. But there's this sort of initial part, a form, all these things you have to say. It's mostly for the internal of the SEC. And then it is back-ass part. But in the middle is that prospectus. Now, that's the thing that's going to be handed out to investors. But you can't hand it out as soon as you're qualified. What you can do is hand out something called a red herring. It's the prospectus, but it's got red lettering on it. At the top, that's on the front. That's why they call it a red herring. You're not allowed to take buy orders on the red herring. It's sort of handed out to special people so that they can see, here's what's coming. And once that lettering is black, then it's a selling document. But before that, it's sort of like a trial, I don't know what you call it, a trial balloon or the prototype. But you have to have the red herring. And then while that quiet period's going on, you have to sit there and stew. There's another thing that is going to go on. When your offering starts, and I think you can do it before the offering these days, there's something called a tombstone. It is, you don't see them as much these days unless you look at financial papers. They're these rectangular statements saying the name of the company, the price per share, the other details of the offering, and the underwriters in the main underwriters in the syndicate. That is called the tombstone. At the top of this tombstone, it says, this is neither an offer to sell nor a solicitation for an offer to purchase the securities mentioned herein. That can be done only through the prospectus, which can be acquired from, and they'll give you an address if you want the prospectus. So the tombstone is an advertisement that's not an advertisement. It's saying, oh, yoo-hoo, isn't this cool? We're selling this stock. Oh, this isn't the selling document. You have to get a prospectus to see that. But this is just sort of like letting you know that there's a prospectus out there that you might want to look at. The tombstone is ancient stuff. And like I said, I haven't seen as many tombstones in recent years, but... And you don't have to have a tombstone, but the big offerings from the big dogs, there's still a tombstone out there. Now, I mentioned underwriters. Underwriters, you can have a firm commitment underwriting. A best efforts underwriting, or a self-underwriting. A firm commitment underwriting is a group of investment banks. Okay, there's a lead investment bank. It says, we're going to buy your entire offering. Facebook, you're selling billions of dollars of stock. We're going to buy it all. And then they create an underwriting syndicate of joiners, of other underwriting firms that will take a portion of what the lead underwriter has bought or what the lead underwriter is committed to. That's called a syndicate. And on that tombstone, you'll often see the lead underwriter and then these lists of these fancy investment banker names. Those are the parts, those are members of the syndicate. So in other words, you will never, in a firm underwriting, see the initial public offering. You are not in the primary market. You cannot buy the stock as it is issued by the company. It is all bought by the underwriting syndicate, and then it is sold to you. So you are not part of the primary offering. You are in the secondary market. The primary market was the underwriting syndicate that committed firmly, we're buying it all. And that leads to all kinds of chicanery, because I can guarantee you that those underwriters are going to buy that stock. They're going to make sure that they sell it to their best customers. Read that they're rich people, their trusts, their mutual funds. And then from there, once the stock price has topped, then they'll sell it to you, you sorry son of a bitch. And you will buy it. And, of course, as they're selling it out of the accounts of their favored customers, the price is going to spiral downward. So you are going to buy, essentially, the top of a cliff. And there's no cliff there anymore. There's just air and your Wile E. Coyote going down and making a puff of smoke at the bottom or dust. That's how it works. That's just the reality of it. You're not going to join in that public offering. You're not part of the primary market. The firm commitment, they buy it all. There's no question, it's going to sell. Now, the best efforts, I never did a firm commitment. I mean, you know, the big boys just laugh their asses off at some small-time thing like me and my companies. Best efforts, one underwriter or a syndicate will say, look, we'll try to sell your offering. We're going to try to. We'll do our best to sell your stock, and we're going to take a commission off each one we sell, but we're not promising anything to you. Sometimes you'll hear this called a Western-style syndicate or a Western offering. Western because the Eastern boys buy the stock and then sell it. The Westerners say, now, we'll try to sell it on your behalf, but we're not making any commitment to you. Western-style offerings, the best efforts, were just my bread and butter, just look, can you give me a chance? Okay, I'm going to sell 100,000 shares at $10 a share. It's going to be 504. Can you do it? Well, you know, we're not going to sell it. We'll try to, but we're not going to buy that stock ourselves. But one thing that they would do is they say, tell you what, we'll give it our best effort if you give us 20,000 shares of that stock for ourselves. Or, okay, yeah, I guess I can do that. I've got another underwriter here out of Seattle. He says he'll do it if you get him 10,000 shares of the stock. Okay? In other words, it sounds like a bribe to get them to promise that they'll try. But it's actually, there's part of it is logical because they're going to do something, no guarantee whatsoever. They could probably end up making no commission at all. Another part of it is that they actually need some stock of this company in the brokerage house portfolio to make the market in it, because I'm going to need them to be able to buy and sell once this stock is out there. And if they get a buy order, they can sell it from their inventory. So it wasn't all nastiness that they did it. And then there is the self-underwriting. Company officials try to sell the stock themselves, and that is absolutely a bear to do. Some states actually make it so hard to do it, you can't do it. Florida actually, when I was a consultant, they got so tired of self-underwritings that they actually said that any company that tries to do a self-underwriting must become a licensed brokerage house in order to do it. Which, of course, we're a company. We're trying to sell our stock to do something. And you want us to become a brokerage house so that we can sell our stock? Other states are looser on self-underwritings. But this is the one that I did a lot of, working with companies. And it's so dangerous to do it. In one case, I mean, there was so much politics, so much nastiness involved. There was a company out of Akron. This was in the early 1990s, and I'd been asked if I'd go up there and see if I could help them get their company underway. The guy who called me was an old guy. He was kind of a retired consultant. He said, "They've really got something amazing up there. You need to go and see this." Now, it was in a backwater, crappy place in Akron, and I pulled up, and I thought, this is like an abandoned storefront. And I went in. And they were waiting for me with something that just absolutely blew my mind. They were doing 3D free-floating holograms in the early 1990s. They had dug a pit 60 feet deep in the behind in the back of this storefront and put concrete into it so that they could have a pier stable enough so that they could do these mappings that were necessary to do the holograms. And they said, "Well, we've already done a couple of really cool things." And they showed me some of the work that they'd already done. They had made everything from a beer can spinning in the air. They had also done a prototype where they had used what back then was computer-assisted tomography, CAT, to map a human heart beating. And then they had this three-dimensional of this human heart beating that was looked at by cardiologists around the world so that they could advise the doctors who were about to do open heart surgery on the person what to watch out for. And they could actually peel the 3D hologram apart. And at one point, one of the doctors in South Africa said, "Right here, see, it's kind of unusual, but this guy's got a nerve right there. You don't want to cut that nerve, and he's got it. And so here's what you do to deal with that problem." It was amazing what they were doing. This was in, like, you know, the Stone Age of technology, like we know it. I was sold. Okay, how much you need? You need, oh, God, you're going to have to do a 506. And there's rainmakers. I got a couple of places I can get some rain, and I got some other rainmakers. We're going to get this done for you. And, I mean, you see a project, and that was where I learned don't get emotional. Don't get an emotional commitment. Because we were starting to bring the money together. And then one day, these were guys that were technology types. There was one guy who was like a construction engineer type. He worked as a volunteer fireman. One of the guys was a burnout from the CIA from the 1970s and 80s. It was just kind of an eclectic group. They were not sophisticated about securities. And so they said, "Well, we've already started raising money." I thought, "Oh, God, no. No, you haven't." Well, fortunately, it was to a couple of wealthy people, so we could get it under the registration. Well, I went back up there. I couldn't get them on the phone for about a week, and so I drove back up there, and there was no one there. And through the grapevine, I found out that they had all been arrested by the Ohio Securities Division of Securities. They had just gone up there and sat down with them and casually started asking them questions. And they were recording it. And these guys didn't know these regulators were wired. Turns out that the big killer was one of the regulators said, "Well, are you paying yourself salaries out of this money that you're raising?" And the construction engineer guy said, "Well, yeah, we got to eat. You know, I guess we're kind of paying ourselves salaries out of that." That was a no-no. He had admitted to a felony securities offense. And they were arrested. They were indicted. They were imprisoned. The company disappeared, and so did its technology. For a few years. I saw that several times where setups were done, technologies were vanished, and then only to show up years later in some big company's hands. Well, there you go. Anyway, let me move on here. Okay, you got your sale. Got your sale. Sell the stock one way or the other, and you got to then follow the rules for the rest of your life. Now, if it's restricted stock, you're an officer of the company. I can actually issue you stock, but it would be Rule 144 stock. And over a period of time, you are allowed to leak some of your stock. You have to get an opinion of a lawyer saying this is permissible for her to turn this many shares of her Rule 144 stock into freely tradable stock at this time. Now, those windows are relatively short. You're not allowed to sell right before you make a fancy announcement about your earnings and all that kind of stuff. You're not allowed to do that kind of stuff. But you can leak 144 stock out from an insider's position, and it becomes part of the overall stock of the corporation that's out there freely tradable. Here's the thing. A public offering of common stock is a very bad sign for a company. A company doing its IPO, a company doing a public offering after the IPO, it's generally a bad sign. It can go from one time I went to a restaurant, and when the waitress served me the baked potato, I opened it up, and it was bad inside. I said, "Waitress, this potato is bad." So she came over, picked up the baked potato, and spanked it. "Bad potato, bad potato." Smack, 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 smack. Put it down on my plate. She didn't get a good tip. He's like, "What the hell?" Okay. Did you ever see the movie Lord of War? Must-see movie. It's based on a true story, Nicolas Cage as an arms dealer. Now, he would sell arms to anyone. The real guy would. And that included arms to insane people who would then go in and massacre entire villages in their quest for control of diamond regions in Africa. Now, that, I think you would agree with me, is bad on a level that goes beyond spanking a potato. Okay, so there you go from it's a bad potato to it's a bad provider of weapons for mass murder. But one way or the other, selling common stock is bad. Here's the first reason. You're going to pay a fee to your investment bankers for selling it. So if I sell my stock at $50 a share, I have to pay my investment bankers. They're going to collect. So in other words, if the stock really was worth $50 a share, then I'm going to get only $46 per share out of it. That flotation cost means that it makes it even more expensive than equity is already. And equity is already the most expensive kind. You saw that earlier in the course. The cost of equity capital is the worst. And when you're selling stock, it's even worse. But that's not the worst of the reasons. The worst of the reasons is this. If I am selling, okay, I've got a business. I'm running my business. Woman, I really want to have you as my equity partner in this. I really do. I've had this business for 5 years, and I really want to bring you in as my ownership partner. Why would I do that? I don't even like her. But I do really like her money. And I'm willing to give up ownership, control, to one degree or another, to get that money you have. You know, when she's not around, I'm calling her a tramp. But when I see her, damn, you are just basically Jesus with, with womanly... Do you understand? Why would I give away ownership unless I am really hard up? Why would you get married? Because you're not getting any the other way. And believe me, you won't after you're married either. So tough luck on you, Chief. It's a sign that you are desperate. You can't, banks aren't going to lend you any more money. There is no other way. You're not earning enough to keep your company. Internally generated equity is not sufficient to sustain your company. So you've got to go out there and find other people, suckers. And once they are owners forever. You're attached to them. Well, maybe she'll sell her stock to someone else. Well, if it's restricted, she can't do that. But let's say that she could sell it to someone else. Well, all that means is that she could do that and sell it to you, and you're Godzilla. I mean, you're going to just tear up the place. And see, I lose control. I lose control to you. And then if you ever get rid of your stock, let's say you die, you can pass it on to your son. And your son is a homicidal maniac. He comes in with an axe and he's wearing a damn ski mask that scares the employees. It's not a good sign. Here's another thing about it. Is that I'm pricing my stock at $50 a share and I'm going to sell it. Well, actually, what that is telling me as an investor is that the stock is overpriced at $50 a share. The stock market ticker symbol says $50 a share. The company jumps on and says, we're going to sell our stock at $50 a share. But that would tell me that that stock, $50 a share, the internal thinking of the company is that $50 a share is too high a price. Why is that too high a price? Because as soon as that new stock is sold, supply goes up, price goes down. So that means that the company's internal dynamics of thinking is that the stock price is really down here at the post-offering level, not at this pre-offering level. That one's a little more, you have to think about it a little bit. But you see, if I've got a price on something, and I think it's worth it for me to do something that would cause that price to drop, which increasing the supply of the stock will do, then I must think that the post-drop price is the actual price that the stock should be at, not the price up here. So this company is actually sending signals, and none of them are pretty signals. One of them is we're willing to take on terribly expensive capital. We'll pay the most that we could pay for capital is new issue equity. We're willing to do it. That's a bad sign right there. And then the fact that they are selling it at the price that is running across the tickers, $50 a share on the tickers, we're going to sell it at $50 a share, that must mean that they think that it's actually, they know it's going to drop in price, and so they must think that the price of the stock is what it would be after that new supply has hit the market and dropped the price. It's a sucker's game. That's why selling stock is not that easy to do, and a firm underwriting is about the best way to do it, because a firm underwriting, what they'll do is they'll buy the stock at that $50 a share, they'll hold it there until their wealthy investors have cooked it for a little while, and then they're going to drop it out into you, and that's where the price will drop to its real level. But they'll keep it up there long enough to make their clients happy. Oh, mother's work is never done. Okay. There are all kinds of flavors. I want to warn you about something. Common stock can come in different flavors, like I said. Obviously, there is restricted common stock versus freely tradable common stock. But even if it's freely tradable, if you don't have market makers for it, you don't have a ticker symbol, how are you going to sell it? So you have to not just jump through the SEC's hoops. You also have to do all of the things that a legitimate stock exchange will make you do in order for them to give you a ticker symbol to list the stock. Mine were on the NASD, except for one which was on the AMEX. But the NASD, everything that I did for the SEC, I had to do a lot more rigorously for the NASD's compliance people. And it was all done on Form 15C211. And after it was over, I felt like the SEC, they were pussycats compared to the way I was treated by the NASD's compliance officer. She just said, you're going to do it. I don't care what you did for the SEC. We're a self-regulating entity. the markets are regulating themselves. That means it's my job to make sure that this market doesn't have cheaters, scammers, and loose ends. So you're going to do everything I tell you. And at the end of the day, once you have done that, if I feel like it, I will give you a ticker symbol. And so I learned to call her evil master. Yes, evil master, I'm not worthy of your contempt. And she said, oh, you are so worthy of my contempt. Sharp old bitch, but okay. But there's also different things about stock. There are different classes of stock for some companies. You see, a common stock share gives you a vote for the board of directors. One vote, one share, one vote per director. That's up for election. However, there are some companies that have a Class A and a Class B stock. The Class A stock, or the Class B, let's say the Class A, is available only to the family of the founders. It has supermajority voting rights. And so, essentially, that Class A, you can never buy it. You would be buying Class B if you bought stock in that company. And your vote would probably not matter worth diddly because, essentially, the Class A has such super majority voting rights and there's so many family members and trusts that have that stock that you don't have a say. You're just along for the ride, which you are actually anyway. So watch it when you're buying some of these big names. Make sure that there's not that one class of stock out there because sometimes, although sometimes those families that control the company are doing what's best for the company, sometimes they just won't let go of old ideas, and so it's kind of a mixed bag. Here's something. You can go to the annual shareholders meeting and buy and use your votes and vote. Or you're going to get in the mail a proxy statement, which is essentially a statement explaining to you that we would like you to give us your votes. We are the management, and we would like, or we are the board of directors, and we would like to have you give us our votes so we can vote for ourselves, and here's why we want to vote for ourselves. So a proxy statement is like that. However, sometimes you'll see a competing proxy statement. In other words, there's a black knight. And that black knight's saying, all right, you got a proxy statement from the insiders. Well, do you really like how those insiders have been running the company? The board of directors now there, they want you to sign a proxy statement giving them the right to vote themselves back in, and yet they have screwed the pooch on this company. We would like you to give us the votes so that we can enter, take over this company, control of this company at the management level, at the board of directors level, get rid of the executives that are there now because they're all a bunch of dogs, and you give us the power to control this company. That sometimes is coordinated with this Black Knight beginning to buy stock in the company, acquiring what we call a stake. S-T-A-K-E, not S-T-E-A-K, a stake in the company. Now, once they've reached a certain threshold, first a black knight would probably just start to buy a few shares here and there quietly through different shells or different entities, and then they would begin to plan their move for the hostile takeover. Eventually, once they've hit a certain threshold of ownership, they have to make a disclosure to the SEC. There's those forms that I told you can find on the EDGAR filing system. That's where they would say, all right, we've hit 5%. Okay, this is what we're doing. We're buying the company. We're trying to take over the company. Now, the company will then, inside the existing board of directors and executive management, seeing that their asses are about to be cooked, they're going to begin to deploy their own defenses. Among the things that they can do is to simply PR the hell out of their position and say, why would you vote for this black knight? He's a dog beater, a cat strangler, a child molester, and in fact, he eats pork. And yet he's Jewish. How could you trust a man like that? They'll do that. They will also begin, if they don't already have them in place, they're going to start building poison pills. They're going to start poisoning the water. One that might happen, like I said, sometimes poison pills have been in place for years. They're defensive measures that have been built into back in the day before there were any attacks, but they said someday we might have one. But other ones are right off the bat. So, for example, a poison pill. If an outside group acquires more than a 40% stake in the company, the company shall issue a dividend of $500 per share. Just completely, in other words, you do this to us, that's a very bad idea. This goes to a famous story about the three missionaries who went to New Guinea to preach to the cannibals. Well, they were captured by the cannibals, and the cannibals said, took them, the first one said, "We're going to cook you, eat you, and we're going to use your skin to make a canoe." And they did so. Well, the other two missionaries are just absolutely terrified, horrified. And then the second missionary is taken the next night. "We're going to cook you, eat you, and make your use your skin to make a canoe." And they took him away. Well, the cannibals are going the third night to take the third missionary, and he's sitting in, they hear from his hut, him laughing and yelling, "Ouch, ouch, ha, 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 ouch, ga, ow." They go in, and they see the man, and he's got a fork, and he's stabbing himself all over. "What are you doing? Ain't nobody going to make a canoe out of me." Remember that. That's a good philosophy. As a matter of fact, I have a poster that I've made and sold sometimes. It just shows a picture of a canoe, and it says, "Ain't nobody going to make a canoe out of me." That's a poison pill that essentially you just fork yourself all over, and then they can't make a canoe out of you and go on down the river. But there are a lot of different poison pills of different kinds, but that's a defense. When you own stock, you buy stock in a company, you're going to get a proxy statement. They'll say, "Please vote for us." You can do that, or you can go to the annual shareholders meeting and make a fool of yourself there and have everyone laugh at you. Or you can just let the big dogs fight their games without you. But remember, your vote doesn't count, because in a company that has 1 billion shares, you own 1,000 of those shares. It doesn't matter whether you even bother to sign the proxy statement and send it in. It doesn't matter. That's all I have for you. Go home.